I'm fine, Dustin. How are you? Is Nathan joining us?
I believe he is.
I have to congratulate you guys on an incredible job with Silo. I mean, I have loved your work. What your team did with Shape of Water, you know, working with Guillermo. It's obvious this is that's a marriage made in heaven. Now, working with Morton and everybody on Silo, I think this is another marriage made in sound heaven. Just absolutely great job here, guys. And I'm curious how you started your approach with the sound design in terms of where you were going to go with this, because you've got to worry about amplification. We've got a mile high, technically a mile high tube, Silo, that everybody's in. You have to think about echo. Smart move by Graham and everybody deciding not to go with the metal steps as is in the books, but to go with concrete. Otherwise, you would have had a hell of a time with all that clomping on metal. But you've got that amplification. You've got background voices. You also have moments of silence, isolation. The turbine, which the sound of the turbine and the mechanic room is just, I'm so beyond impressed with that. And of course, then balancing the score as part of the sound. Because, and something I have to compliment you guys on is that I could hear every bit of dialogue. Quite often when some sound guys start balancing things, they overcompensate and we lose dialogue if there's a particularly loud sequence like the turbine roaring. Dialogue was never sacrificed, but it never felt forced on the auditory range. So where do you even start when you get a project like this?
I think we start by thanking you for those compliments on behalf of the mix team, Steve Foster and Kirk Lins, because those guys, they played a pretty significant role in making sure that you could hear every single detail and that, you know, music could drive the emotion of the scene without sacrificing too much sound effects and obviously carving room for the beautiful clarity that Dustin brought to the table with the dialogue edit.
Well, and I am just one cog in that entire machine as well. We were so lucky on this project because every single person involved was top tier and like brought all of their talent and insight to make this thing work. So
where did you start when this got handed to you from a sound perspective? What was your starting point? Was it, you know, the ambient sound of the Silo itself that you have to adjust and fine tune based on floors and height and depth? You know, where did this begin?
Yes. I would say yes to that. I don't know. I don't mean to speak for you, Dustin, but at least on the sound effect side of things, we definitely took a broad strokes approach and developed focus as we proceeded through the process of building the show. So, you know, we started pretty broad and vague with the wider Silo sound and introduced more and more specificity as we increased the detail and presence of elements that you could hear. And then honestly, like any other process, you know, you start there, you build this very detail rich sound palette, and then you enter the game with the mixes of, okay, what needs to be heard here? What's getting in the way of dialogue? What's getting in the way of music? What's getting in the way of sound effects? Who's most important? And, you know, we kind of lean on them pretty heavily to help answer those questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For me, as the dialogue sort of person in that department, I started with the book. When I was told that I was in the running to do this show, I got really excited about it, and I read the book, and I had previously read another series by the same author and really like his take on things. So I read the book, and it kind of gave me a sense of a lot of the nuance that may not translate to the screen visually, but could be something that we could bring audio-wise into the TV show from the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a lot of little notes of, like, what sort of details in terms of, like, who, like, what is the politics of the silo? Like, where are we sonically at any given time? Like, what should the Down Deep feel like in terms of emotion and in terms of how busy it is, et cetera? What do the mids sound like? What do the up top sound like? What types of people are going to be there? And what are their sort of like attitudes and personalities are like? And that informed a lot of the decision making in terms of our background voices, like our Walla and Loop Group and stuff like that, and how we differentiate those levels. But then it's like Nathan was saying, at any given point, it's like, what's telling the story? Like, is this purely a conversation, or do we need to bring in music to either support the emotion of the scene or undercut that scene? Is the scene better without music and maybe being more sound effects focused? A great example of that is when Holston goes out to clean and he's in the suit that feels, you know, very claustrophobic and very disorienting. That's a really good moment for sound effects and Holston's dialogue and breathing and stuff to lead that scene. Other times, like the rebuilding of the generator, like there is a lot of sound effect stuff going on there, but really it's a music moment and a performance moment from the actors. So at any given time, I think once you get to this level of the game, it's about what's telling the story the best, and you favor those elements, and everything else can support that choice.
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious with the generator, the turbine, the mechanic room on every level, I think is one of my favorite elements of the entire show because of the magnitude of the work that went in from a physical production design standpoint to VFX, to camera work, to sound. That to me is the heartbeat of the silo. And the sound helps give it that sensibility of being a heartbeat for the silo. But I'm curious about layering in the various effects because of the cacophony of noise in there. What kind of challenges did you face, and what sounds did you create? New sounds for the turbine, for the generator, or did you pull them out of a library? I'm very fascinated with your approach to that room.
Well, I mean, the answer to that is kind of yes to all. We definitely recorded a lot, and we can touch on that. Dustin and I, we had an interesting day recording sounds. But you touched on something pretty significant there in calling it a heartbeat of the silo, because that's really where we started, was with elements that felt like a heartbeat when we first got the first cut of the I believe it was the pilot episode. They had put in this music track. Was it from District 9 or something like that? They borrowed a music track from an existing film for the temp score that was pretty unconventional, had a lot of sort of steampunk clinks and clanks and bangs in it. But that was the rhythm section. But they sounded like industrial sounds rather than musical ones. And we were just basically told that we like this. The creative team, you know, told us we like what this is doing to the scene, and we'd like to try and emulate that, and we don't care who it comes from, whether it's sound design or music, it just has to be there. And so, I mean, that's kind of where I started. I started with rhythmic elements that kind of gave it a pulse, that let it breathe, that could, you know, in a world even without music, you would still have a driving beat moving forward, and then built on that to, as you say, give the silo a heartbeat. Once the music all came in, then it became a game of, okay, addition via subtraction. How do we get out of sound effects? How much do we get out of sound effects? What sound effects do we leave in? Because, yeah, the actual raw build of that generator as it existed in the tracks that were brought to the stage was wildly detail rich. Like it was, there were tons of layers, and on its own, it played it as a beautiful element. But in the story, it would have stepped on toes. It would have gotten in the way a bit because, you know, the music through those scenes, especially I think it was episode 3 where they had to shut down the generator and start it back up. You know, we couldn't be in the way. We it's barely making it over this roaring generator. You know, it was just a matter of playing things with a subtle balance to make sure that, you know, it was clear this is a loud room without making dialogue unintelligible and without overloading it with just the, I guess, the realistic sounds, like the tactile presence, you know, getting hung up in the minutiae of what would this sound like, and take a step back, zoom out, and ask, you know, why are we playing these sounds in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something that I would say, too, is that Morton did such a good job of directing, particularly episode 3 and really episodes 1-3, anytime we're in the generator room. He was really careful to make sure they were all yelling at each other, like really, really yelling. And that is something, like, I'm not going to call anyone out, but I feel like a lot of directors underestimate how much you need to get loud environments to get people yelling like that, because that actually gave us the real sort of canvas to which we could build a loud room. And their performance all felt appropriate for the level of, you know, cacophony that we brought to it. It also meant that because they were projecting so much, it allowed us to, you know, bring our levels up to match so that it could truly be loud without drowning out what was going on. Mm-hmm. Or sort of drowning out the dialogue. So, like, hats off to Morton. Like, he got that right, and the performances was really that canvas that allowed us to fill in such a, like, big and loud space.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's so important.
And filling that with elements, like, you asked if we were largely relying on pre-existing elements versus how much we recorded. And as I said, it's kind of yes to both. There were elements that just came from libraries that would be high-res metal ronks and groans that got fed through samplers and twisted and distorted and contorted until they sounded like giant whale moans, and it was this big suffering generator. But then, like, there was the realistic sounds, like the exposed rotor blades, and that's where it kind of, you know, Dustin and I, we're old friends. We've been friends a lot longer than we've been professionals in the sound business, and so you know, we've gotten into some sketchy situations before in this.
This is one of them.
Yeah, this is one of them. We basically, Dustin took up metal work, and we went over to his house and started doing things that,
attaching things to power tools that probably should not be attached to power tools, and
we wear safety equipment, but our behavior was unadvisable, and pretty good foundational elements for those rotor blades.
Oh my God. So, in other words, this was a do-it-yourself moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, making something out of nothing, grabbing recorders and creating sounds that didn't exist before. A lot of the sounds that give those rotor blades their velocity and impact were live sounds on the floor of Dustin's garage with us probably too close for comfort.
Wow. Now, did we suffer any recording equipment casualties as a result of this workshopping you did?
Maybe a cable, but no, pretty good. We did well.
We planned for it as best we could, considering what we were doing, and I think it was largely successful. Like, neither of us got hurt, and
sounds lethal.
When Band-Aids don't come into play, it's always a good thing. Wow. Now, you mentioned something really key, Dustin, about Morton and the fact that he actually had the actors yelling. And I so appreciated that during those mechanics, the generator room sequences, because you can see, especially with Rebecca Ferguson, when she yells, you can see the veins in her neck and her muscles strain and tighten, and that makes all the difference in the world. There was no question that she was yelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things, to go back to, or to expand on what I was saying before, like, often you see in movies, you know, a scene in like a bar or club, and the actors are like not projecting, and then they have this like techno beat in the background. and you can just tell, like, or even if you can't, I think cognitively put it together via maybe you're just not in the industry and you're just a casual watcher, I think you feel like there's something wrong. Because, like, I don't know, like, the music's cranking and why are they whispering to each other? It feels weird. Like, it's one of those things that just doesn't feel right. And the fact that Morton got them to yell, like, it literally felt like the space was way bigger than it was. And I'm sure it felt super weird for the actors on the day to just be like, are you sure I need to, like, yell this loud? Like, no, you absolutely do. And it was perfect because it really made the space feel loud and big. And it's, like, one of those things where it's, like, it works when it's done right.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, because, like, if they performed that any other way, the scene would have been totally different. Everything would have been more subdued because we would have had to bring everything back to still have that clarity, and there would be no urgency to it. It wouldn't feel as dangerous as it actually was. So it's like one of those tiny little well, I wouldn't say it's a tiny decision, but it's like one of those decisions that happens so early on in the process, and it affects everything that comes after.
It definitely works, because as you're talking, I'm just now imagining, had this been more subdued, the sound is what gives us the sheer magnitude. As an audience, that is what gives us the sheer magnitude of the size of this generator, this turbine, to power this mile-high silo and all of the electrical within it.
And
were it not done this way,
depend on that machine, and
yeah,
it feels like
it. Absolutely. Absolutely. So that was a very, very important, that was a big decision that Morton made. That wasn't a little one. That was a big one. And it really works to the betterment of the series.
Back to your point about the veins popping out and stuff, like, that is so important that it was performed that way on the day. Because it's another one of those, you know, pulling the threads on the sweater. If they didn't have that physical performance on screen, and then we went into ADR and made them yell louder, like, sonically, there would be the mismatch there, and it wouldn't look like it fit together. Because, you know, if someone's just casually saying something, and all of a sudden, like, you hear them yelling, but their voice, or sorry, their face isn't suggestive of that action, it falls apart again. And I think, like, everyone here knows about that because we're all in the biz, but people watching it just feel that disconnect. And they're like, I don't know, something's weird about that. It didn't work for me. But, yeah, it's one of those things where they got it right, and it paved the road for us to do everything else right behind it.
Yeah. Now, you guys mentioned something really, really key, is the different sonic levels for the down below, the mids, and then those at the top. And I love how that is differentiated yet feels cohesive. There's a lot more noise down below. You get, you know, a little less noise, a little in terms of volume and ambient background. And then by the time we get to the top, it's everything is very quiet. The mayor is very quiet. Tim Robbins' character is like in slow motion, and everything is calm and quiet. There's no chatter around him. And I love how you guys have differentiated that. Was that a challenge to differentiate as greatly as it is, but still have it cohesive?
I mean, it wasn't a challenge per se. I think it was just, it took a bit of planning. Like, when I mentioned about reading about the book, I started thinking about the silo in terms of, like, what are the analogs in our daily life? And if you, say, go to a factory, it's shift work. Like, there's always something working. It's big buildings. People are, like, loud. They're, like, you know, there's, like, that energy where it's, like, we need to get things done. Like, come on, let's, like, pull on our boots and, like, let's get at it. And it's, like, I tried to bring that energy to the down deep. The mids, to me, felt sort of like a residential suburb where it's, like, you know, you got families. There's a bit of 9-to-5 work. So there's a little bit more life, but it's also, it's got a friendlier vibe than, say, the down deep, because it really is, like, there's lots of little kids and stuff like that. And then the up top, I got the idea for what that should sound like. I was renewing my license plate sticker, like all we have to do here, and I went to City Hall, and it was so quiet. It's like a big, prestigious building. No one's talking. There's like the odd footsteps on marble, like ting, 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 off the, like it feels very, very cold and sterile, and like you're not there to necessarily have fun, but like it was just very, very isolated, like the sounds and stuff. So I tried to bring that vibe, like say a government building or something, to that. So it was like, because you know, IT's up there, and the IT office itself is a little bit busier because there's people doing stuff, but like you said, Bernard Holland's office is so quiet. The judicial level is like a ghost town. Like nobody, it's like a police station. People are afraid to go there. You don't end up at judicial for no reason. So it's like, yeah, just thinking about those different levels or different elements of our own society. And it's like, where can I stack them in the silo? That's kind of informed my decision-making about those three main areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the sound effects side, I was drawing, like, as far as difficulty, I think it was actually made pretty easy for us by the visuals, but one of the early sort of sound bites that we were given in terms of how these things should sound, I remember Morton referring to the Down Deep as Hell's Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then like the opposite, you'd look at the up top as being somewhere in Washington, some boardroom in Washington, D.C. sort of thing, right? And so like we would, when we were in the Down Deep, yeah, look for a lot more industrial sounds, and then up top it was libraries and, you know, hospital waiting rooms and things like that to sort of give it a bit more of a reserved sensibility.
Mm-hmm. And of course the medical...
The visuals supported all of that. The visuals made a lot of decisions for us, you know.
They really did, and I particularly liked the silence that we got with Juliet hiding in the nursery area of the medical wing or hallway, however it's referred to. But you use silence very well throughout the series. In addition to sound, it's the silence that also speaks volumes with the placement and how long you hold it in certain instances. And I really appreciate that.
Silence is a very big sound, and I think it can be underplayed as easily as it can be overplayed. But yeah, I mean, silence, you know, I see it as being more than the absence of sound. You can be discreet about how and when you choose to say or play nothing. That can carry a lot of weight in a scene. I mean, I've always been a fan of the old cliche, you know, loud is easy, you know, show me something quiet that's interesting to watch and then we're talking, you know. But yeah, I think silence is a big sound, and I appreciate you saying that that you felt our use of it and the mixer's use of it and Ben Braffman's use of it was appropriate to the show and kept you locked in.
Yeah, it really adds a lot, and in very key moments. But I like the judicious use of it, of silence, and also how it's timed, the pacing of it, how long it's held. So it's never uncomfortable so that it takes us out of the emotion. And that's really tough for a lot of people to pinpoint when they're cutting. So
it takes a lot of opinions in the room. Like it takes, you know, everybody in the room scrutinizing everything they're hearing, you know what I mean? And having, you know, I'd be on one side of the room, Dustin's on the other side of the room. The mixers are sort of in it, doing the you know, adjusting levels. Ben's in there with us, and we were all just kind of constantly listening. And, you know, when Steve's fingers are on the faders, he's trying to adjust for levels, and then he'll sit back and listen and start asking questions. Or, you know, Ben might chime in, or Dustin or Kirk, somebody might notice, you know, I think maybe we should reconsider whether or not we're playing enough or too much, you know. I think it just takes a lot of experienced ears in the room to really kind of come to a consensus as to when and for how long you should play silence.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes back to that philosophy that I think we all had, where it's like, at any given time, what's doing the best job of telling a story we're trying to tell?
How grateful are both of you to the fact that this switched from the book with metal stairs, a metal staircase in the books versus concrete in the series?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with that decision.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, because at least if they had used metal stairs on set, you wouldn't have had to carve out so much dialogue and reshoot it as ADR, because one of the big things in the silos is there's no wood, and they had to build those out of wood. And so there was a lot of ADR work for Dustin to do through those stairs.
And now we're getting into the weeds here a little bit, but it's harder to get metal ringing voices than it is to get, like, just dull thuds and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if we're talking about book differences, can I just say, changing Walker to a woman and casting Harriet Walter, genius.
Brilliant.
Absolute genius. And Harriet Walter is, I mean, she's a legend. What more do I need to say about her? She's so phenomenal. And to, like, have her sort of playing the mother figure for Juliet was something we didn't have in the book, but, like, works so well in terms of helping us find our motivations with, or helping Juliet find her motivations. And a lot of the stuff that, you know, book readers can get via just internal dialogue doesn't work in a TV sort of situation.
Right.
So to make that switch from the book, just get, like, just brilliant, brilliant work from the producers and writers. It was awesome. And, yeah, she's amazing.
Now, like you, I have read the books. I've read the series. So for that change to occur, I was very happy with that. Because like you, I'm happy to see her no matter what she does. Harriet Walter, I mean, she can just sit there and read a phone book to me. And she will put so much emotion into it. But yes.
She's just the best. She's probably, I'll say she's probably the most talented actor I've ever worked with, period.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Phenomenal.
But yeah, I was very happy with that and very happy how they built out the character of Walker once they switched it to a female role.
Yeah. And her relationship with Mayor Johns and her relationship to her ex Carla, like the whole thing, like that's something. And like Hugh Howey as a writer, I think works really well with TV adaptations, because he leaves so much room for the characters to have life breathed into them by actors. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
He sketches them out just enough that they do what they need to do in the book, but isn't so focused on the details that our incredible cast could come in and bring something new to it.
Oh, absolutely.
And, like, the casting is just phenomenal. Like, Bernard Holland being played by Tim Robbins, like, could there be any better casting than him for that role? Like, unbelievable.
And he scares the bejeebus out of you every time he's on screen, because he's so quiet and so methodical in his delivery.
And yes, and there's just enough of him being like the IT nerd that you potentially dismiss him as being a villain. You're like, oh, he's just like a nerd, and he's, you know, he's concerned with his own thing and people stepping on his toes. But then for him to ride that line, whether or not he's good or bad, all the way to the end, and then when he truly reveals his true colors, he's terrifying. Like, absolutely terrifying. And, but like you said, not in an angry and aggressive way, but because he's so cold and calculated.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm so in love with this cast and their performances, if you haven't already noticed.
Oh, no, you think? Now, are both of you working on season two?
Well, I'd love to. Things are in flux, as
right.
I'm sure you know, because of, you know, the state of the strikes. But as far as I understand it, Graham did write all of season two before the strike happened. So, like, from a writing standpoint, I think it's ready to go. And I believe they were shooting, but I think like most productions, they've had to pause it. We'll see what happens. I would absolutely love to come back and do season two, but with everything being in flux, it's hard to know how all of the balls are going to drop.
It would take a scheduling overlap to prevent one of us from taking part. But yeah, I believe it's their intention too. But we'll have to see how the strikes shake out.
Yeah. So who knows how long it'll be before you guys, you know, can get called back in for season two.
I'm looking forward to it, though.
Yeah.
I'm dying for season two. Have you read the second book, Dustin?
I haven't read the second book yet, but I'm sure as you've read the books too, we haven't really gotten to the end of book one yet.
Yeah, there's so still a little more to go.
That happened that I can't wait to see.
The way that this season ended, I was like, no, no, where's episode 11?
Yeah.
I figured
an ending though, right?
Oh my
like,
God.
No way to reveal that part of the story.
Yes. I'm just really, it was one of those gobsmacking, jaw-dropping moments.
Yeah. As a non-book reader, if you see that moment and you're like, oh, this is so much bigger than I thought.
Yeah. Just absolutely phenomenal. Now, you two had to pick out the most gratifying aspect of the sound design, the sound editing and mixing of the series as a whole, what would it be for each of you? The most gratifying aspect of it.
I mean, I feel like Dustin touched on this before. For me, it's just the team and how well everybody gelled, like having everyone involved that we had involved, to offer a couple extra shout outs on the sound effects side, Craig McClellan and Jack Madigan, who was our junior editor, so he worked on both sound effects and dialogue. Everybody was just really, really in tune with each other. We had a great shorthand. We've worked with the mix team a bunch, so it was just a really well-oiled machine, and it's nice when you've got something with the subtle complexities that Silo has, and not to have to worry about those shorthands and not fumble any of the main decisions. Everyone's kind of, we start on the same page and end on the same page, you know, because we've worked together so seamlessly for so long.
And I'm going to add to what Nathan said. I agree with everything he just said. But also for me, and I have to touch on this because you brought it up at the very beginning, Debbie, is that you can hear all of the dialogue. And that was so important to me. And it was so important to my whole team, like starting right from our production sound recordist, John Mooney. He cared so much about it. And I do too. Like, I'm one of those people who, like, my blood boils when people are like, TV sucks, you can't hear anything anymore. And I'm like, no, we can do it, trust me. We can find a way to make everything work. And my entire team cared the same way about it as I did. And everyone brought their expertise to really make sure that we could capture those performances. And having seen the show, Debbie, you know, like a lot of this, like it's a mystery. And a lot of these conversations are very hushed and like,
yep,
whispered secrets all of the time. And it's like you have a big noisy place and people whispering secrets. We have to find a way to make sure those come through. And John Mooney was amazing. My dialogue editor, Kristen Hunter, was amazing. Like, she is so good at, you know, all of this really complicated surgery with taking outtakes and syllables from one place and putting it somewhere else. So, like, you really get all of the clarity that you need. And, of course, Steve Foster, our dialogue mixer, is just, he cares so much about that, too. And, I could not have done what I did without this team. And, we're just so lucky that all of us got together to do this thing because it needed all of us to really pull it off.
Well, I have to tell you, Dustin, that key for me always with dialogue, with sound mixing, when I'm watching here at home, and if it is mixed so poorly that I can't hear the dialogue for the score or the other ambient sound effects that are happening, and I have to increase the volume on the TV to hear the dialogue. To me, that is a problem. That is a problem. And I maintained, I have the volume on my TV set, at, for movies, I have, or a series like this when I'm binging it, at 27. I never had to take it up above 27, whereas typically with other films and things, in translating it for airing on television, on cable, I've got to ratchet the sound up to about a 35. So wow. I never had to touch the sound adjustments watching this.
Oh, you've stolen my heart, Debbie. That is probably the biggest compliment that I can get, aside from, like, I didn't notice the ADR. Those are, like, the two things that, like, I try really hard to get right. And it's one of those things, too, where it's, like, if you do get it right, people don't even notice it. So to have someone actually point it out and say, the thing that I didn't notice was great, that's maybe the highest compliment you can pay me. So I appreciate that.
Oh, well, I appreciate all the work that you both and your teams did on Silo. Just an impeccable job when it comes to the sound. And I know a lot of the guys at Formosa. I know our wonderful Emmy-winning Mother of Dragons from Game of Thrones, Paula Fairfield. So I know a ton of sound people. So sound is always so important to me in a production, be it film or television, and your work here is impeccable.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, gentlemen, thank you so, so much. This has been wonderful chatting with both of you, and I hope we get to do it again in the future.
Again.
Yeah. There. Or even for your even for your Freaky Tales production whenever that comes out.
Oh, that's a fun one.
That's a very good movie.
I hope you go and see it, Debbie. It's a very different thing, but a similar sonic feast, and it's absolutely a very fun film.
Well, it is on my radar in large part because of Anna and Ryan, who I was there at the very, very beginning with them with their very first film. So I have I have gone through this, each of their films and the progression that they've done as writers and directors. So this has been on my radar since the project was originally announced. So I am really anxious for this one.
They're such lovely people, eh?
I'm sure you'll get a chance. You'll probably get an advanced screening invite then, and I would encourage you to take them up on it. They were total sweethearts, like career highlight to work with them. They were fantastic. So.
They are two of the nicest people I've been doing this as a critic for over 40 years. I worked in the industry for a number of years. Definitely, hands down, two of the nicest people I have encountered.
Yeah. They're just regular people, and like, maybe let me
confirm. Yeah.
They're just like, how do I put this? Directors of their stature could probably get away with a lot of, like, shitty behavior. And they have no ego. They have, like, they're just film, like, cool film people that just want to do cool stuff. And they're really nice. They've got great ideas. And they love collaborating. Like, what more can you ask for as a creative? Like, to work with such, like, down-to-earth cool people who are also super talented.
You could ask to work on Silo Season 2, which is
true. And, of course, I'm excited with Freaky Tales that they're reuniting with Ben Mendelsohn. Who they worked with before.
Yeah, you'll get it. It's good.
He is so good. Oh, guys, I can't thank you enough. This has been a pure delight this morning.
Oh, likewise.
Oh.
Agreed. Thank you for such awesome questions, too. Like, you never know what you're going to get with, like, a reviewer. Like, are they truly fans of the project? Or like, but, I mean, clearly you are, and you're deep into the book. So, like, thank you for such enthusiastic and insightful questions. It was great.
Well, you are very, very, very welcome. I like asking questions because what I do is I go behind the lens with everything.
That's your website, right?
That's my website. That is my weekly radio show. It's Behind the Lens. You guys go have an incredible rest of your day. And until the next time, thank you, thank you.
Until next time. Thanks, Debbie. Really appreciate it.